Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and me, Tris Dixon. This week we are going to do something slightly different. We're going to look at, our greatest fights, and we'll go round in order of five down to one in terms of the greatest fights we've seen, with maybe a little bonus bit at the end. So, Ian, I'm not sure how much prep you've had to do since we said that this was going to be the topic, but what have you got down as your number five?
Well, I had a bit of a debate. I mean, a joke crossed my mind that a good fight would be Prince William against Prince Harry to put on an undercard. No, joking aside, this is a huge debate and it's very, very difficult to separate because there are so many quality and classic fights. And then, it's how do you define great? It can be just like the quality of the action in front of you or just the size of the story and the occasion. So I'm going for Barry McGuigan's win over Eusebio Pedroza as my number five because the atmosphere there was, well, it's hard to describe it now to anyone of the modern generation. It was at Queen's Park Rangers football ground. Those who've been listening to Barry's podcast he did with us, and very kind of him a couple of weeks ago, will be familiar now with the story. But if you didn't, Barry was a huge cult hero in Northern Ireland, and he tried to, be unified, did not get involved in all the terrible bullets and riots and troubles there, and tried to stay neutral. So he was a huge story, and this was his big day against the longest reigning world champion of the time, Eusebio Pedroza, and I don't think anything would have stopped him that night at Queen's Park Rangers. It was full, the audience, and it was 8 o'clock, not 11 o'clock at night like it is these days. It was 8 o'clock at night, live on BBC One, 19 million people tuned in to see it. That's how big Barry was, and he fought the fight of his life and became world featherweight champion. So it was a wonderful event to cover amid a manic atmosphere. Everything really that boxing should be with a happy ending. So that's my number five.
John, where are you for number five on our countdown?
Well, I'm going to go a little bit more recently. I mean, I've kind of tried to restrict this to fights which I actually commentated on. And I'm going to go for the one at number five just before Christmas in 2018. An absolutely sold-out Manchester Arena and Josh Warrington and Carl Frampton, which, okay, they might not be two of the absolutely elite-level featherweights of all time, but my goodness me, what a terrific fight they put on. I travelled the country with the two of them, going to various venues, helping publicise the event prior to the fight. And, it really did prove that fighters don't have to hate each other for it to turn out to be a great fight. This was gentlemanly throughout in the build-up. There was a lot of mutual respect between the two of them. But when the fight began, by God, what a contest it was. First round, Warrington goes out like a man possessed and almost puts Frampton down in the opening round. And remember, Warrington had come into this on the back of that excellent win against Lee Selby. Frampton came back, boxed his way back into it, but Josh always seemingly had the upper hand. A couple of judges gave it by four rounds, one by three rounds. There was no animosity, and we walked away from it, people saying, well, that truly was a tremendous boxing match. It was, I was there when Ricky Hatton fought Costa Zhu some 13 years earlier, which was a fantastic fight itself. But I think this one was right up there.
Yeah, and while I've got you on that, there was a period of time where it looked like Frampton wasn't going to get out of the first couple of rounds, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It looked as though he was going to get stopped. And he came back wonderfully well. I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, Triz, I think it's fair to say that Frampton was never the same man again after that. And arguably, that was probably the pinnacle of Josh Warrington's career as well. And it might be that he wasn't really the same after that one. I remember afterwards being in the dressing room. I was in Warrington's dressing room, and there were loads of sort of well-known people around. I mean, Gazza turned up, would you believe, who clearly was three sheets to the wind, but he came and paid his respects and said what a great fight it was. And then while everybody was chatting and just reflecting on what we'd seen, in walks Carl Frampton. And the lovely display of respect between the two. It's one of those great things about boxing, isn't it? You know, I mean, we see these savage contests and then the two men hug each other and know that however old they are, whenever they get together, they'll always remember that night and they'll always know that they shared something very special.
Yeah, so I've also got a top five, and I've sort of cheated a little bit here because there were four that nearly made the top five, but didn't quite. And I did just want to mention them for different reasons, really. There was Bernard Hopkins' outstanding win over Felix Trinidad in Madison Square Garden in 2001, which was a night caught up in patriotism because it was the first big event in New York after the Twin Towers came down. Which was, you know, and that night will always be a special night for me to have been at and a part of. Then there was Joe Calzaghe's excellent win over Mikel Kessler in Cardiff, which really delivered. There was violence, there was tactics, there was supreme world-class boxing from both, and that has to be in there. Then there was Frotch's coming out party against Lucien Boutte. I say coming out party. It was really when he got everything back on track, having lost to Andre Ward in the Super Six, and he completely routed Lucien Boutte in Nottingham. And then there was Amir Khan, who also does actually feature higher up the list, when he was hurt, wobbled against Willie Limond in a fight that he was expected to win very comfortably on his way up, that turned into a real war. And he had a real battle with Willie Limond at the O2 Arena. But my fifth fight actually goes to an undercard fight at the O2 Arena, and it was Kevin Mitchell against Carl Johansson. And it was on the undercard of David Haye against Enzo Macronelli. And I remember Haye Macronelli didn't really deliver as we'd hoped it would. But people like myself didn't mind because we'd already been served this feast of brutality by Mitchell and Johansson, which was a real classic domestic fight. And it was, you know, two guys that were fringe world-class operators. And you could argue from this, John, as well, you said about Frampton there, but you could argue that neither of these were the same again after that. It was a incredible fight, and definitely one that probably doesn't get the credit it's owed years down the line.
Well, the pair of those two, Triz, I mean, they were never in dull fights, were they? Mitchell and Johansson. I mean, Johansson wasn't a great talker, was he? Let's be honest. But my goodness, when it came to fight time, that lad could really deliver. He was a tough guy.
Yeah, very much so. And Kevin Mitchell had a fight of the year with John Murray as well, and a couple more. Obviously, he lost to Katsidis, but then he came back and gave Linares a tough fight too. Ian, where are you for your number four?
Well, we're going on size of stories. We mentioned that at the start. And this was one of the biggest stories in the history of boxing. So I'm going for Mike Tyson against Buster Douglas at number four. This was regarded as so much of a formality at the time that there were only three British media men who went to Tokyo to cover it in February of 1990. I'd been covering the Commonwealth Games because I'd done a bit of athletics. And I only got the call just as I was about to get on the plane to come home from Auckland. From a producer called Emily McMahon, who said, have you got on the plane yet? So I said, well, no, that's why I'm answering your phone call. She said, well, don't get on the plane. We booked you on a flight to Tokyo to cover to Buster Douglas, Mike Tyson. I said, well, why are we covering? My reaction was, oh, well, are we really covering that? You know, it's a formality, isn't it? I said, nobody's going to that. So I think there was only Colin Hart, who ended up doing the commentary with me, and a guy from the Daily Mirror, who were saying everybody else, so I would just cover it from back here. I mean, Tyson was regarded still then, although he was starting to maybe to fray around the edge, but for the last 4 years, he'd been regarded as invincible. And you know the story about James Buster Douglas. You know, he's the 42-1 outsider in this fight. A guy with some ability, but didn't really look like he was in love with the game. Only did it because his dad wanted him to. Sometimes he looked good for a while. Mostly he was a huge disappointment. So here he was anyway, getting this chance. But his mother had just died recently, and something maybe just lit the fire inside him on that occasion. Suddenly he became a fighter with all the courage and spirit and commitment and passion you need to succeed at that level. And, you know, it was Andy Warhol's cliched 15 minutes of fame for him. He fought the fight of his life and basically beat Tyson up. I mean, he was flawed himself in the eighth round. There was a row about how long the count was, but he wiped Tyson out. And, you know, that story sent reverberations, not just through the world boxing, but right around the whole world. And it was amazing, really, to cover it. And as I've, I think, revealed once or twice in these podcasts before, Evander Holyfield joined us on the commentary. I'd met him in a lift, and he didn't have a seat at ringside, so we invited him to sit with us. And we never ended up paying him anything. He didn't want paying. So, yeah, that's my number four anyway. I think, you know, For the new generation, that's the background of that, you know, great story.
But also with that, Ian, it wasn't just a huge seismic upset. It was actually a good fight, wasn't it? It was entertaining. Like you said, Tyson, there was always the feeling, or there was a feeling that Tyson could do what he did in one of the rounds and turn it around with one punch. He was always in there and dangerous. And I think probably it was one of those things. I don't know if you felt you could see it all unfolding in front of you, but it was one of those. Until Tyson was down and groping around for his mouthpiece, he was, you know, it hadn't happened until it happened, if you see what I mean.
Exactly right. I mean, because always the feeling that Tyson would catch up with him in the end, and we thought in the eighth round that was exactly what was happened. He'd been outboxed and knocked around, but he'd found that punch to put Douglas down. He thought, okay, reality's going to crowd back in here and the form book will be obeyed in the end. But you know, Douglas survived that. I mean, the extraordinary thing about that occasion, it was in the Tokyo Dome, was that the crowd were not like a normal boxing crowd, you know, all passionate and screaming and shouting through it. It was like the crowd at Lord's. That's how the Japanese fans behave. So at the end of every round, they would break out into a round of applause as if somebody just hit a four at Lord's in the test match. I was saying on the commentary, this is kind of crazy. You know, what we're watching is sensational. The crowd's reaction is polite and subdued.
Sweet Caroline, be damned.
Yes. I think it wasn't only you know, sort of the world who saw things unfolding before them. I think it was certainly Don King as well, wasn't it? He saw his gravy train rapidly disappearing, and he did everything possible, as I remember, to try and get the thing declared null and void.
He did, because he said the count was too long. He held a press conference. We were all invited to a press conference 3 hours after the fight in another part of Tokyo, where Tyson stood up and said he'd been robbed. And King said, that, like you say, John, that the events, it's null and void because of that. But don't worry, Douglas will get Buster Douglas will get a rematch. So I remember Eddie Schuyler, who was a witty guy who used to do the AP report, said, shouted out, "What's on the undercard, Tunney and Dempsey?" And then he launched into Tyson. Schuyler launched into Tyson and said, "How can you stand up here and say that that is an invalid result? You're the guy that's supposed to know the whole history of boxing and everything that's ever happened in boxing. And you're standing up here and giving us this sham, farcical opinion that you weren't beaten fair and square today. You should be sitting down, Mike." And Tyson had no reply to that at all. He just sat there sheepishly. So, you know, there was a worldwide outrage at what King had tried to pull off there. And within a few hours, you know, the result was declared kosher. And, you know, so common sense prevailed. But, yeah, he tried to hijack it. He tried to change it, Don King.
Ed Schuyler was one of the great, one of the that sort of great breed of that era, sort of the world-weary cynic who wasn't at all afraid about taking people on and absolutely exposing bullshit for what it is. I mean, it's indicative, I think, of the way that the media's changed, that there are so few people around now who would be prepared to do that kind of thing. So many people are swinging from the promoters' coattails one way or another and are afraid just to not step outside the party line. And Ed Schuyler was certainly somebody who did. He was a great character.
Yeah. I mean, you need more of that, don't you? Particularly in boxing. I mean, you know, your predecessor, sorry, just lost my voice for a minute, but Harry Mullen, your great mate, John, and your predecessor, Tris, you know, I mean, he was always falling out with the promoters for taking a strong line, wasn't he, in boxing news about stuff?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we've all fallen foul of all of them at boxing news. I don't think the boxing news editor's role is one of the most popular in boxing, shall we say. John, where are you for your number four?
Well, number four, I mean, this is kind of a controversial one. I was tempted to go with the great ear-biting thing, you know, Tyson and Holyfield 2, although the fight I'd have really loved to have seen was Tyson Holyfield 1 back in November 1996, when Tyson was not only beaten, he was beaten up by Holyfield, who outgamed him in every aspect of the fight. So had I commentated on it, which I didn't, because I was marooned in Manchester doing Nigel Benn and Steve Collins on the same night, which wasn't a great fight, I would certainly have had Tyson Holyfield 1 in my list. But I'm going to go actually to the previous year. And I know it's a controversial one because of what happened, but I'd go to the London Arena in February 1995, February the 25th, 1995, and Nigel Benn and Gerald McClellan. McClellan was a massive favourite to win that fight. Something I seem to remember, it was something like 3-1 on, and there'd been a really acrimonious and bitter build-up with Benn very much of the impression that Frank Warren and Don King, who were business partners at the time, had brought McClellan over to the UK to fight him at the London Arena, to get him beaten, to get him away out of their hair, somebody who was too much trouble, to get him beaten and out of the scene. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. I'm sure Frank would deny that 100%, but certainly that was how Nigel saw it at the time. And when the fight actually started, it was the most extraordinary occasion, incredible atmosphere. There wasn't, of course, a spare seat in that 12,000 seat arena. It was one of the most one-sided, patriotic, bear pit sort of atmospheres that I've ever experienced anywhere. Prior to the fight, McClellan had said, when he was asked how it was going to pan out, he said, "I can't see anything happening other than another vicious knockout for me." He had Benn out of the ring in 35 seconds, and it looked as though it was going to end in the first round. There was a long count, although having been out of the ring, the rules, I gather, were that you are allowed actually 20 seconds before you get back in and the fighting resumes. And it was 13 seconds that Benn was out of the ring. So maybe the referee was right to allow it to continue, although McClellan didn't see it that way. And then, of course, as the fight unfolded, Denny Mancini in the Nigel Benn corner did an extraordinary job with the Dark Destroyer, saying, "Look, you're still in this. You can still do this. You can still do this." There was Frank Bruno standing at ringside, punching the canvas, bellowing his support. Lennox Lewis and Linford Christie, two of the great sporting icons of the time, were sitting right behind me while I was commentating with Henry Cooper, and they were sort of slack-jawed in their admiration, admiration awe, if you like, at what they were seeing. McClellan came back. He put Benn down again in the eighth round, but then things started to go wrong. And as we know, it had actually been unfolding for some time before that, with McClellan blinking uncomfortably. He took a knee in the 10th round, and accounts happened then. And then a second time, he went down again. And this time, the referee counted him out. I remember Henry Cooper, and apparently on the American broadcast, Ferdy Pacheco broadcasting for Showtime, they both said, he's swallowed, he's quit. He's been outgamed by then, and he's quit. Well, what, of course, they didn't know at that stage was just how seriously injured Gerald McClellan was. He collapsed in his corner, taken to the hospital, and one of the most frightening and tragic outcomes of any fight began to unfold. But, you know, when I look back on that one, Triz, I always say, people say, you know, what was a great fight? What is a great fight? That fight for me kind of touched every base. Bravery, brilliance, gladiatorial confrontation, and then ultimately the sort of tragedy that we all fear in boxing, and one which makes us question our allegiance to the sport.
Do you think, John, that maybe what happened in the wake of that fight and the terrible injuries to Gerald McClellan kind of stops it being a great fight? Everything you said is absolutely correct, but there's always that massive cloud, isn't there, hanging over what happened that night. I remember when I was watching it, I wasn't commentating that night, but when I was watching it, I was starting to feel uncomfortable. It was a little bit like the thriller in Manila, where you're thinking, people here are going way beyond the boundaries that they should in the name of sport. I mean, I guess that happens quite a lot in boxing, but I started to feel that about that night, as spellbinding and thrilling as it all was as it happened.
Yeah, I take that. And but you know, I mean, that's kind of always the bottom line potentially in boxing, isn't it? And while what happened is awful, and Gerald McClellan is having to live with the aftermath of that contest to this day, and I don't think Nigel Benn was ever the same again afterwards. But you actually look at the contest itself, and I still think it was absolutely spellbinding.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
John, if let me sort of paraphrase Ian's point there, because I agree with Ian. It's a very difficult one, isn't it? Because when I spoke to Conor Benn about this a year or so ago, he said, well, you know, I hope if I'm in a fight like that, no one ever calls it a great fight, you know, if he winds up obviously injured. But then obviously you can't help but remember what it was like to be there that night before injury struck. I suppose where I'm going with this is, had there not been an injury that night, would this have been your number one?
Quite possibly. Yeah, quite possibly, because I didn't actually, you know, at the time, I wasn't ambulance chasing afterwards, so I didn't know the full extent of the damage until the following morning, when it became clear, you know, was it John Sutcliffe who did the operation? He saved Nigel, he saved Gerald McClellan's life and relieved the pressure, the bleed on the brain. But he was unconscious for goodness knows how long, Gerald. It's 2 weeks or more. And yeah, it was frightening. And as I said in my initial highlighting of this, it was a fight which made you question boxing as a sport and whether or not this was something that you wanted to be involved in. And part of me still thinks that now.
Well, I think any intelligent covering boxing always has to have that slight ambivalence. I know, you know, great Hugh McIlvenny always spoke about it as well, didn't he? You have to be aware of that element of what we're covering. And I think everybody was. I understand why John's got it on his list, because as just a spectacle for boxing, there were very few nights to touch it. But the level of savagery involved in that and how deep the fighters had to go did make you a little bit queasy as well.
Yeah. So my number four is, it was over in Las Vegas, and it was Amir Khan fighting Marcos Maidana. And Maidana was this obviously huge punching opponent, and people were going into that fight thinking, you know, all Maidana has to do is land and it's going to be lights out. But Khan came out firing. He folded Maidana like a deck chair in round one with a body shot, which imagine if Maidana had stayed down, he had every right to, because it was such a crippling body shot. Imagine what a win that would have been for Amir Khan had he got Maidana out of there in a round. But things didn't work out that way. Maidana fought his way back into the fight, and come round 10, 11 or so, Khan, somehow, this guy who's not supposed to be the most durable, was taking bombs, huge right-hand bombs from Marcus Maidana, and Khan stood up to them. Yes, he was wobbling around the ring, but obviously Maidana had knocked men out cold with those shots before, and Khan held on terrifically to win a wild fight on the cards over 12 rounds, and I think that might have been Amir Khan's peak performance in many ways, not in terms of boxing science, which we saw him do better against, you know, against the likes of Devin Alexander and Kotelnik for the world title and stuff, but in terms of heart and prime and everything else, I think Khan was brilliant that night.
Yeah, I mean, because you're right, Tris, the reputation of Amir Khan was that he was gifted but a little bit chinny, you know, ever since the Bradis Prescott, you know, blowout shock defeat in, what was it, 54 seconds. That's kind of what people thought. So, yeah, I'd go along with you. That was a massive night for Amir Khan, really, where he did prove a lot of people wrong. And it was a really brave performance.
Yeah.
I don't think that Amir gets the credit that he deserves, you know. I think now when people look back, I think people criticise Amir excessively. Yeah, he didn't have a granite chin, and you know, we all know that. But my goodness me, he didn't back down from too much, did he? Maybe things were tarnished just a little bit towards the end with a couple of his performances, notably Cal Brook, and when he went over to America as well, when he fought Bud. I mean he's kind of loses credibility a little bit through those. But some of those performances earlier in his career, and notably that one which you highlighted there, Triz, I mean, he was a very exciting fighter. And I think part of the reason that his fights were such compulsive viewing was that vulnerability, because he hadn't got a great chin. And you always knew that if somebody landed like Bradis Prescott did, he could go.
Yeah, and he ducked no one. Like you said, Bud Crawford, he even got the Brook fight signed, sealed and done, even though it was 5 or 10 years too late. And then obviously going up in weight to fight Canelo, which was a suicide mission, but he was doing well until he wasn't. So, Ian, where are we now with number three?
Number three, I've gone for another massive big British fight occasion this time. I better put one in. So I'm going for Ricky Hatton's win over Kostya Szyu in Manchester. You know, what a hero Hatton became in Manchester. It was a phenomenon, wasn't it? He would fill out that MEN arena every time with 20,000 people, even on the way up. And this was the night we'd been waiting for. We thought would never come. It seemed to be an eternity before Hatton got his big world title opportunity and got this guy Szyu in the ring. And of course, Tzu was a Russian based in Sydney some of the time. He was an Australian national. He'd first won the title 10 years ago. His only defeat had been against Vince Phillips in 1997, which was, what, eight years before. De La Hoya described him as an animal, a beast. He's there to knock you out. And he did have a fearsome reputation. I think he'd been hardened by beatings he'd had in the gym from older boys, and he'd had to run barefoot in snow and all this kind of thing. And, you know, he was such a hero that the rebels in Tatarstan declared a truce, you know, when his fights went on. So could Hatton do it, really? I mean, he was so popular, and, you know, that sort of choir boy looks, great body puncher. And on the night, him and Billy Graham, his friend and trainer, they devised a great strategy, really. They decided they'd get into the kind of range which would deny Szyu the real leverage for his very heavy punching. And I think, you know, he would walk through walls that night. He'd have walked through fire. I don't think anything would have stopped Ricky that night. And he was crowned world champion. Szyu didn't get off his stool for the last round. And, you know, Bedlam broke out around Manchester. So just a wonderful night. And for a very popular fighter, you know, it's the old cliche about, you know, nice guys never win. Well, that nice guy did win.
I remember, Ian, after that fight, and you mentioned the incredible atmosphere. I mean, we were staying over the other side of Manchester in a hotel just near Piccadilly Gardens, the Malmaison, and we were walking across, and our whole team was there. I remember there was Duke McKenzie, I think the guy who commentates on Formula One for Sky nowadays, Crofty, I think he'd presented. And we were on the way over, and the production team as well. And I said, guys, you really ought to remember this night, because as far as British boxing goes, I really don't think it gets very much better than this. And what Ricky Hatton did tonight, I don't believe that he's ever going to be better than he was.
Very prophetic words, John. You were right.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to be a smart ass here, but it just really stood out as such. You said, talked about bravery and his commitment and his almost a sense of destiny. Ricky was extraordinary that night.
So, John, where are you for your number three?
Well, I'm going to go to the other side of the Atlantic. It was one of my earlier trips over to America, 1992, and the first of the three fights between Evander Holyfield and Riddick Bowe at the Thomas and Mack Center. Holyfield, he was regarded at the time as the world number one. He was the favorite to win this one. Bowe, undefeated. He came into it as the underdog. He's the bigger man, stood 6'5" against Holyfield, who was, what, 6'2½" or something like that. But Bowe was terrific that night. It was voted by Ring Magazine as their fight of the year. And I'd certainly go along with that so far as heavyweight fights anyway that I saw that year. It was a great confrontation. Eventually, Bowe won it fairly clearly and unanimously on points. But what stands out for me, I remember, and I'm sure everybody who loves boxing would echo it. You know, if you've never watched heavyweight boxing at its best, get on YouTube, find the 10th round of that fight, and just watch the sheer brilliance of it. Bowe had dictated the first minute and a half, 2 minutes of it. It looked as though he was looking for a stoppage against Holyfield, who seemed to be being outgunned. But Holyfield, as we saw so many times before, they didn't come any braver than that fella. And he bit on his gum shield, came back, rallied, and produced the most extraordinary onslaught on Bowe in the last minute or so. It was a great fight. There had to be a rematch. There was a rematch. Holyfield won the first one, which was, of course, the fan man occasion. And then there was the rubber match, which went to Bowe. It was a great trilogy, but I think that the greatest fight and one of the outstanding heavyweight fights that I've ever seen was the first one at the Thomas and Mack Center, Holyfield-Bowe one.
Yeah, and I think that was the fight that made Holyfield's reputation. He'd done so much as a cruiserweight, but nobody really thought he could make the step up to heavyweight, not effectively. And that night, I think his reputation went through the roof. Sometimes in boxing, where so much is about perception, you can win when you lose, and he did that night.
And what a gentleman as well. You know, I mean, he'd lost it, and he was ultimately well beaten, but he didn't go and hide away. He didn't surround himself with an entourage. He didn't look for a press conference 3 hours after the fight. 20 minutes, 30 minutes after it had finished, he was up there in the press area, battered, bruised, but taking every question which was thrown towards him from everybody in that room. And he showed himself to be one very, very class man.
Yeah, he loved the media, did Holyfield. He hung out the press room sometimes just waiting to be interviewed. What's your number three then, Tris?
So I am back in Europe, but I'm in Denmark, in Herning. For John, I'm not sure if you did this one. I think you might have done. Karl Frotch against Michael Kessler, the first one.
I did, yeah.
And I think that was on primetime, am I right, over here? But it was part of Showtime's Super 6 tournament. And it was just an incredible rock'em, sock'em, robot-style thing. I mean, obviously, with hindsight, Frotch was delayed going out there due to the volcanic ash that had spread across Europe from a volcano, so he went there on a rickety, you know, some sort of rubber band what am I trying to think of? Some sort of local aeroplane that I think made him very, very queasy going out there ahead of the fight, which I think, you know, for the fighters, it was on, off, on, off. But then when they started, you kind of predicted that it was going to be a violent, feet planted, sort of all action fight. And that's exactly what it was. And it was a battle of attrition, and neither gave. The only thing that I thought separated the fighters on the night was Kessler being picked up by his countrymen in rounds 10, 11, 12 and being cheered to victory. And it was a razor-thin decision, but I thought Kessler probably just about got it. And Froch is unfortunate not to make the list with this with the rematch when he won a very similar fight at the O2 in London, and that was on Sky box office, I think. Froch Kessler won in Herning, Denmark. Outstanding fight, and for me, better than the rematch, although Froch probably disagrees.
Can we just sort of go off slightly at a tangent on that one, just while we've got time? You know, when you look at Karl Froch, this is probably one for you, Trish, since you brought it up. How good do you think he was? Was he just somebody who was tough with a good chin who survived because he was a hard, hard man? Or do you think that he had ability which is underrated?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I've just finished writing his bio for the International Boxing Hall of Fame program because he's being inducted this year. And no, I think he's sold short. I think he's an underrated boxer. I mean, the guy was a bronze medalist in the World Amateur Championships, two-time ABA champ, so he had some pedigree. I think he's a fascinating study, Carl. But I mean, the thing is, as well, you can't be overrated and mixed with that gauntlet of fighters that he had. You know, from winning the fight with Pascal, I think there was one fight that was maybe a gimme after that, the Youssef Mack one. Everyone after that was a blockbuster. It was Andre Ward, Anthony Durrell, Kessler twice, Lucien Boutte, two fights with Groves. It was an astonishing gauntlet of fights that he went on. Glenn Johnson. There's a few. Oh, Arthur Abraham, who was obviously meant to be a real headache at the time, and Froch outboxed him on a wonderful exhibition in Helsinki. So I think he was underrated. But I think obviously his main attributes probably were his chin and his power, or his guile and will to win. But that doesn't mean that he can't box, and he had underrated ability. He'd never have been able to beat the likes of that varied. And if anyone thinks he couldn't box, go and watch that Arthur Abraham fight, which for me was akin to, I'm not saying it was punch for punch similar, but it was akin to Calzaghe Lacy in the sense that Abraham couldn't touch him. He was absolutely brilliant that night.
Could he have touched Calzaghe, do you think?
Not for me. I mean, it was about timing, and I think they just didn't overlap enough. But if you were to put them in a time capsule and go prime for prime, it's Calzaghe for me, based on work rate and ability and speed, probably as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think I agree with you both. I think underrated Froch, but I still think Calzaghe would have probably just had a bit too much for him. Pity we never saw that one, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but also happy that it didn't happen in a unsatisfactory cross-generation type fight where one was slightly on the downside and one was at his peak. If both at their peak, yes, please. But at different times, not quite for me. Number two for you, Ian.
Number two for me was just a privilege to be at the first fight between Marco Antonio Barrera and Eric Morales, the two Mexicans who genuinely hated each other at the time. They don't anymore, I'm told. But at the time, they were so different and from such different backgrounds. Barrera, that rare, it's almost a middle-class boxer. I think his dad made movie sets in Hollywood and all that kind of thing, whereas Morales was your gritty blue-collar tough guy champion. So when those two met, and you mentioned there when we were talking about that last fight about two people at that meeting at their peak, that's what we got there. And what we got really was nothing less than a firefight for 36 minutes. It was just non-stop quality. You were watching moves and skills right out of the top drawer, great jabs, brilliant counter punching, great judgment of range. It was the sweet science at times, and then other times it would go into a blood-curdling blitz. And we just got 12 rounds of that. It just never stopped. And I remember doing the fight with Glenn McCrory and Bob Mee sitting alongside us, and we just kept shooting each other glances while we were commentating, thinking, can you believe this? I can't believe this. It really was absolutely breathtaking, just brilliant to cover. And I remember walking out thinking, I'm not sure I'm ever going to see anything that good again. You know, the only thing that kind of slightly spoiled it was I did think Barrera had edged it and should have got that decision, but they gave it to Morales, so that there was the controversy. We could have done without that, because I do think the right result would have been Barrera to edge it, but you couldn't really argue for long. Just a wonderful, wonderful night. So that's my number two.
I think technically, Ian, that's the best fight I ever saw. I wasn't there. I was watching on television. And, you know, I was an armchair observer of that one. But I think that technically, that's the best fight I ever saw.
John, where are you for your number two?
Well, yeah, it's not anything like technically as elevated as that one, but for the story and the occasion, I'm going with Mill Street in 1995, back in March, when Chris Eubank lost his undefeated record and lost his WBO title to Steve Collins. St. Patrick's weekend, if you remember, it was an amazing occasion. There's been a local horse from Killarney called Doran's Pride, which had won a big race at Cheltenham, which was on at the same time. And I think the whole town had backed that one. And, you know, so everybody had money in their pockets. They then went on and cheered on Steve Collins at the arena there, which had hosted the Eurovision Song Contest a little while earlier. And of course, Collins produced this amazing performance and won it. And then there was the massive celebration afterwards at the big hotel there, the Great Southern in Killarney, which was it was one of the great nights, I tell you, it really was. But the build-up had been extraordinary to that one, because, of course, Eubank was carrying on his career with the shadow of the Michael Watson business still very much part of his psyche. And Steve Collins had exploited this by saying that he'd been hypnotized and was going to be hypnotized by a guy called Tony Quinn, and that when he was hit, he would feel no pain. When he bled, he would not bleed. That this guy would make him something very, very special and give him a superhuman advantage against Chris Eubank. Now, Eubank heard this. I actually did an interview with Steve Collins, and, you know, I mean, to get a reaction, which is how we work, I played the interview to Eubank where he came out with all this stuff, and Chris was completely spooked. He got hold of Barry Hearn and he said, "Have you heard this? I'm not in this fight. I'm not doing it. This fight is off. I'm not prepared to go into it and fight against a man who doesn't know when he's hurt. And I'm not prepared to go through all that again." And certainly for several hours, and possibly even overnight before the fight actually took place on the Saturday, that fight was off because Chris Eubank had said, "I'm not prepared to go into it." But then the fight happens, of course, and it was a terrific fight. Ronnie Davis probably gave Eubank his biggest punch of the fight when he slapped him across the face after having Steve Collins down in the 10th round. Eubank, as so often after Watson, realizing that his man was physically in real trouble, he stood back, gave him time to recover, and Ronnie Davis said to him with a statement which proved to be very, very accurate, he said, "You're going to regret that for the rest of your life." And Collins got the verdict, narrow but unanimous, on all three judges' cards. And afterwards, he said, with a bit of justification, "We fooled the world."
Nice stuff. Nice stuff.
Yeah, it's mentioned there, the fight was off the night before the fight. I lost count of the number of fights that were off the day before the fight because of some row. And you got just cynical about it in the end and just said, it's going to happen. And of course, it nearly always did.
Yeah, I can't tell you. The Friday night headline glove row stories have become very, very tiresome, haven't they? So my second one is back across to Vegas, and it's the fourth fight between Juan Manuel Marquez and Manny Pacquiao. And it's funny, really, because obviously, you know, so I've written a lot about damage, and it was a fight that was so violent and so incredibly violent. Both fighters were dropped, and it was a lot of two-way action, but Pacquiao was definitely getting the upper hand, and it was really billed as the fight to put the whole rivalry to bed. They'd had three fights before and very little to separate them between. You know, people thought Marquez had won at least two of the three, and he hadn't got one verdict. As good as he got was a draw. And so there was a lot to settle, a lot on the line and a lot at stake. And Pacquiao was putting an exclamation mark on the rivalry until he walked onto this huge right hand that was, you know, one of the most devastating knockouts in the history of the sport. And he was put out flat on his face, down and out. It's one of those things where, you know, you don't mind saying this really because it's what's going through your mind, but you actually think he could be dead. You know, he was down and out, and it was just the most horrific looking knockout. And there was a big part of me that was not only very concerned for Pacquiao, but I was actually very upset that the fight had ended because it was such a thrilling spectacle of two-way action that you think that, you know, you could really do 12 rounds of it. Probably it was like the Barrera Morales thing where you think, oh my God, this is great. This is, you know, I can't take my eyes off it. And then when it was over, you kind of felt like, you kind of felt with hindsight now, it was such a huge knockout and such a famous one. You kind of don't feel deprived. But at the time, I just remember thinking, oh, I was enjoying that. And now it's over. And I suppose, and you know, I don't know if that's bloodlust or what. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I can put it down to, because obviously, you know, ultimately people do go for the knockout, and that's what we got. And a hell of a knockout it was too. And I remember, you know, even then the rivalry wasn't really settled. Pacquiao wanted to fight Marquez a fifth time to try and put it right. There was all sorts of allegations being thrown to Marquez as to how he'd made welterweight and seemingly being a different frame to the welterweight who took on Floyd Mayweather, even though that was a catchweight fight. So it should have cleared everything up, but really it left a lot more questions than answers. And I felt a little bit deprived of not having another six rounds, but the first six rounds were among the best six that I've ever seen. And the knockout was right up there with the most chilling I've ever seen. So that is my number two, which probably shock a few people who've read Damage. But that's why I'm in the sport, I guess. I kind of watch it like we said near the start. It's a guilty pleasure. Which brings us to our top fights each. I'm looking forward to these. I've got no idea where we're going to go with this. So, Ian, you first.
Okay. And this is an undisputed choice as well. As good as Barrera Morales was, my number one is 1985. They called it simply on the billboards in Las Vegas, The Fight, Caesar's Palace, Marvin Hagler, marvelous Marvin Hagler against Tommy Hearns, the hitman. What a night that was. The adrenaline rush of covering that, I can't really describe it. On a sultry, warm night, a packed crowd. Marvin Hagler had been the world middleweight champion for 5 years by then. He had this ferocious shaven skull aura. He'd come in underneath that hood. He was a brilliant, tough fighter with all the skills. Good switch hit as well. And looked like he was just going to carry on being the middleweight champion for as long as he wanted. But Tommy Hearns, who was coming up the weights, had been a great welterweight champion. He'd been involved in a clash already against Sugar Ray Leonard in 1981, the one they called the showdown, both of them at their peak. And he'd been dominating that fight until Leonard turned it round. Now he'd had other wins as well. Reputation as a massive, massive puncher, Hearns. And a lot of people thought that he would knock out Hagler even. But Hagler's view about that fight was, look, this is my division, my domain. You're coming up into my division. And basically he said, and this is why it was a great fight, he was basically saying to Hearns, you want to have a tear up? You think you're the puncher in my division? Come on then, let's have it. Let's see if you can do that. And what happened in the first round, it is still, I mean, if there's any rounder that can top that, please show me it. The first round of Marvin Hagler, Tommy Hearns, for the younger generation who haven't seen that, please get it out on YouTube or whatever you do and find that round. Because at the end of it, Colin Hart from The Sun, dear old Colin, was doing the commentary with me. It's the only time I've ever seen him speechless. For about 5 seconds, couldn't talk at the end of the round to do his summary. And he was like choking. And the first words that came out were, I can't believe what I've just seen. That's the greatest round of boxing there's ever been. And it was extraordinary. And I remember getting a letter later from an amateur boxing coach in Kent saying he'd enjoyed the commentary of the fight, but could I please have described a little bit more about what punches were slipped and parried? So I sent him a kind letter back saying, thanking him for his interest, saying, please watch the fight back in the first round. You will find there weren't too many punches slipped or parried. anyway, it goes on. You know, in much the same vein, you know, it was only 8 minutes of it, but it's still my number one. Hagler gets cut in the second round. The referee, Richard Steele, goes over to the corner and famously said to him, can you see okay? Marvin, can you see? And Hagler looked up and said, I ain't missing, am I? And with that, Richard Steele walked away. The fight goes on. And then Hagler takes over and he does win that battle of strength and power, and said, yeah, welcome to the middleweight division. I'm the king. And by the way, I'm still the king. And he stops Hearns in the third round. But it was just a sizzler never to be matched in my mind.
Just to underline that one, I actually, this fight slightly predates my time working at the forefront of things with BBC Radio. And I was at home listening to the commentary of Ian and Colin. And I know afterwards Ian thought he'd gone too far over the top. He thought it was too much. But I tell you what, as radio commentary goes, that fight was one of the most thrilling that I've ever heard on the radio. It was just sensational. And you and Colin were brilliant.
Yeah, I was manic. I still think it's crazily manic. Well, I've heard it back again since. There's a guy called Steve Futterman, who's a great reporter in LA. He's got a tape of it, which he sent me. He said he plays it in his car from time to time because he loves his boxing. Yeah, and the other guy who listened to it, because it went off late. It wasn't like 4:30 in the morning like most of these big fights are. There'd been delays on the night. It was like sort of 6, getting on to 6:30 a.m. in England by the time the fight actually happened, which meant a lot more people heard it. They'd got up. And Brian Redhead, who used to produce present the Today programme, a brilliant presenter. The next time I came back to London, I did the sports desk on the Today programme. He said to me, young Mr. Dark, he said, I have to tell you, you excelled yourself. He said, you made me interested in boxing for half an hour. On the radio as I was as we were sitting waiting to start the show.
Well, it's just as well you didn't freeze in the excitement of it all, Ian, and just as well you didn't come to a grinding halt, and you know, just as well you weren't speechless.
I wasn't speechless, but I probably spoke too much. I mean, it is, you know, just professionally now looking back, I thank John for his compliment, but it was on the manic side. But what a night.
But hey, yeah, I was going to say it was a manic fight, so you sounds like you did it justice. John, your top of your charts is what?
Well, I was fortunate to be the man to have the microphone in my hand for all three of those amazing fights between Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder. Now, I personally think that in my time working in the sport that Lennox Lewis was at the top, that he was the best, but he didn't really have contests to rival the fights between Fury and Deontay Wilder for sheer drama. First one, you remember, there was Fury down in the last round, seemingly out, got up and got the controversial draw. Second one, he relied more on his power. He changed trainer and he got Wilder onto the back foot, did a number on him. Wilder out, stopped. But there was the controversy with Wilder saying he shouldn't have been stopped. He could have continued and then finding every excuse under the sun about what had gone on. And then the third fight. Now, if you remember, it was supposed to be Anthony Joshua against Fury. It didn't happen because a judge ruled that there was a clause in previous contracts which said that Fury had to fight Wilder, and Wilder wanted that fight. He made him take the fight. I went over there thinking, well, we've seen the fight twice before. We've seen the draw when everybody thought that Fury won. We saw the second one where Fury knocked seven bells out of him. And the third one, we thought, well, this is just a formality. Well, when it happened, it turned out to be the most extraordinary fight. It really was. Both of them career heaviest for the third contest. Wilder down in the third round with a right hook from Fury. Fury down twice in the fourth. The first knockdown, absolutely extraordinary. Down a second time. Some of the American commentators, Andre Ward, said there'd been a slow count and that Fury should have been counted out, but Fury found the resolve to come back. Wilder was down in the 10th round, and then the final round, he went down again, big right hand, and Russell Moore, the referee, said, that's enough. Bob Arum, I mean, he's given to hyperbole, isn't he? But he said, that's the most magnificent fight I've ever seen. Well, I'm not sure it was necessarily the best fight of all time. I think technically there's been many which have been better, but for sheer drama from the fights on which I've commentated, I think that third fight between Fury and Wilder was probably the best.
Yeah, I think it was the trilogy fight that we didn't know we needed, right, John?
Yeah, I mean, nobody really thought it was going to happen, did they? They didn't think that it was going to be the magnitude that it was. And I think a lot of people played catch-up afterwards. I don't think pay-per-view sales were particularly good because everybody saw, you know, rematch, we've seen the fight, there's only one winner here, Fury's going to win easily. And as it turned out, the sheer drama of that third fight. I mean, Ian had echoed this. When you walk out after commentating on a big fight, as a commentator, you kind of feel, yes, you feel exhilarated, you feel uplifted, but you kind of almost feel physically drained. And that was one of those.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still wondering how Fury got up from that last round knockdown. I don't think I've ever seen a fighter take a punch that big and get up within 10 seconds.
No, it looked as though the lights had gone out, didn't it? It looked as though he was going to be down for 10 minutes, never mind 6 seconds.
Yeah, goodness knows what shape he must have been in to recover that quickly.
My top of my charts, I was actually there as a fan, so I don't know if this one really counts, but I was there when Mickey Ward fought Arturo Gatti the first time, and they shared 10 incredible rounds at the Mohegan Sun, and it was just the most breathtaking thing. I was probably about halfway back in, so I wasn't in the cheapest seats, but the seats weren't the best, but it was just an incredible thing to be part of. You know, they set their stalls out and they hurt each other repeatedly. It looked like Gatti's superior boxing might get on top, but then Mickey dragged him into a real gunfight of the OK Corral is basically how I'd describe it. And in the ninth round, when Mickey decked Gatti with a body shot and it looked like it was all over, Gatti somehow not only made it to his feet, but then started firing back to sort of almost claim a share in the round. But then by the end of the round, which had to be the longest 3 minutes in boxing history, Gatti was holding on for the last part of the ninth round. It was, you know, some people still call that the best round in boxing history, and it was astonishing. And I just remember there being a fan, the fans around me, there was a clutch of six or eight of us, and I was on my own, and there were two or three groups on either side of me, and I'd look on either side and the guys were on their chairs high-fiving complete strangers, thinking, we can't believe that we're seeing this. And it was just, you know, people went there hoping for a hardcore fight, and that's exactly what it was, and it delivered. And actually reminded me of another story that I had about Mickey, actually. When I was training in the Catskills, I was staying in a resort called Forlini's, and I remember they had a little bar area out the back where they'd allow me to go and watch the boxing on ESPN. And so I had this, I had a Mickey Ward fight with Emmanuel Gustis or Emmanuel Burton on at the time. And there was a couple, and I was dead keen to watch this fight because I thought it was going to be an absolute tear up. And someone came through and they had the fighters' records on the screen, and both of them had lost, between them, they'd lost more than 20 fights. And I said, you need to come in and watch this fight. This is going to be breathtaking. And they were like, oh, look, these guys have lost 20 fights. Like, no, I'm not interested. And then after a couple of rounds, the person came back from the bar and saw what was going on. And he's like, oh my God, I need to watch this. And then in between rounds, every time he would come back with more and more people from the bar. So this fight that started with me on my own in this room watching ESPN and a small TV wound up with about 50 guys all drinking, loving this fight, seeing Augustus and Mickey Ward going toe to toe. And it sort of, it was very similar. It was like a bar version of being at Ward Gatti 1. And I was actually at Ward Gatti 2 in Atlantic City, but I didn't go to the third one because I was at the Hall of Fame, and I ended up watching it at a friend's house, which was a shame because I should have completed the set, really. But yeah, so that takes top spot. But what an incredible plethora of fights over the last 40 or 50 years between us. Hey, that's an awesome collection.
Imagine if we could put that out as a video, we could all retire, you know, with all those 15 fights on, you know, you know, the greatest.
You can pay for the right, Ian.
Today, but I think we should do it as a separate episode. We should do an episode like this of the fights we weren't at but would have loved to have been at in history. So
yeah, maybe five we should of do those. That as a,
I agree, there's quite a lot, do you know, as well,
I think people will think that we've shared our notes and not overlapped, but we've not shared anything, and we've just picked 15 different fights.
Well, that just shows we're bad judges.
Because you can't agree on anything.
That is incredible, isn't it? You know, and none of us have got the Rumble. Oh, because we weren't at the Rumble in the Jungle. That explains that. But that might be on the list of our dream fights when we do it. The ones we go to.
Yeah, we might have to share our notes ahead of that one. But guys, this has been a whole lot of fun. It's nice to be back with you both. And yeah, I can't believe that. 15 outstanding fights there. 15 five-star fights there for sure. But guys, thank you very much for tuning in to Ringside Rewind with me, Tristix, and Ian Dark and John Rawling, as always. If you're enjoying the podcast, please go and rate and review it where you listen to it on iTunes. Give us a favorable five-star review. It's hugely appreciated, and it helps people find our podcast with the algorithms and all that cool stuff. And if you're enjoying Ringside Rewind, please share it. Share the link. Share it with your WhatsApp groups. Share it with your friends. Spread the word. And we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.